Kia ora, everyone. I'm Emmeline Pat-Dahlstrom from Space Base, a social enterprise focused on catalyzing the space entrepreneurial ecosystem, starting in New Zealand to solve challenges on Earth and beyond. You're listening to the Space Base podcast. Today, I'm interviewing Bettina Pavry, Senior Principal Engineer at Paeahu Robinson Research Institute, Victoria University of Wellington, where she is supporting development of high-temperature superconducting magnet technologies for space applications. Prior to moving to New Zealand, Bettina has a long and illustrious career at NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where she worked on many aspects of the Curiosity Mars rover mission as a spacecraft integration and operations engineer and manager. Bettina holds a BA and a BS degrees in physics, engineering, and applied science, and a master's in geological sciences. Welcome, Bettina.
Thank you. Really glad to be here.
Yeah, so really super excited to hear about your career journey, particularly your time at NASA JPL and of course, the Curiosity Mars missions. But let's start even earlier. I know that you moved to New Zealand last year from the U.S., but where in the U.S. did you grow up?
So I was actually born in Los Angeles, and we moved around a lot as I was growing up. I ended up going to secondary school in the state of Pennsylvania, which is in sort of the northeast part of the United States, and then moved back to the Los Angeles area in California for college. So moved back and forth across the U.S. a couple of times as I was growing up. But it was great. It gave me sort of exposure to a lot of different people and cultures across the United States.
That's awesome. And I mean, of course, seeing from your background, was the interest in space right from the beginning, or was it a gradual process?
I would say it was part of my general curiosity about the world. So when I was growing up, I was interested in all sorts of things. I was interested in weird rocks and bugs and strange plants and anything strange or unusual. I wanted to understand it. So I loved science of any kind growing up. And of course, math is the language of science. So I also became interested in that. And I found that as I got older, I was very intrigued by the exploration of our solar system. And a lot of that had to do with the time that I was growing up. That was the time that many countries in the world were first exploring both our moon and then other planets in the solar system. So there were missions to Venus, missions to Mars, missions to Jupiter and Saturn. So all of that was happening as I was growing up, and I became intrigued about it, hearing about that in the press and on television shows I watched. And so I said, hey, that sounds exciting. I'd like to be a part of that.
Was there a particular influence, either a person, or you mentioned, you know, TV shows? What TV shows were those?
So when I was growing up, the primary thing that I really recall influencing me was a science popularization show from the U.S. that was called Cosmos, and it was hosted by the astronomer Carl Sagan. And he was active as a scientist in exploration of the planets in our solar system. And he had a great skill at communicating science to a general audience. And I remember watching that show, and he walked us through history about how people learned about science over time and new findings that were happening as the show was made. So that was a huge influence on me as I was going through my secondary education, and made me decide that I really wanted to go into that field when I got into university. But I didn't quite know how to get there. Nobody in my family came from a science background. And so it took me a little time to figure out once I got to university how I could pursue a field like that.
That actually segues to my next question, because when you went to university, so you chose physics and engineering degrees. Can you take us through that process of deciding why that is the case?
So a lot of my motivation actually is that in the United States, much of the exploration of the solar system, robotic exploration of the solar system, happens at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is located in Pasadena, California, in the Los Angeles area. And the primary university that works with JPL is called the California Institute of Technology. And I really wanted to go to Caltech, but I didn't have the opportunity to start there at university. But there was a liberal arts university that I was able to attend that actually had an exchange program with the California Institute of Technology. And they offered a opportunity to spend 3 years doing a physics degree and then transfer to Caltech. And I had the opportunity, because of that background in physics and engineering, to start internships at NASA JPL. So I had sort of figured out that my path to get there, to work for NASA doing this kind of work, was through physics and engineering and this exchange program. So it was great, because having exposure to physics, it's such an important background for so many sciences, as well as engineering. And so I think that was a great background. And then from there, I decided that what I really was interested in was learning more about the science, which explains why I ended up going to doing my master's degree in planetary geology. So, and that general purpose background ended up being really good for working on missions where you're exploring planets. You understand some of the science and you understand the engineering, and that enables you to communicate well between those two communities to hopefully set up a successful mission.
Yeah, so that's a great insight, and especially for the people who are probably listening to us in terms of like the importance of doing internships. And yeah. I know, of course, this is for your situation, yeah, it's in the US, but I think it transfers to, you know, either whatever country you're in, doing internships is certainly kind of like a foot in the door towards something that you're potentially really interested in. Can you give a little bit of an insight of how to go through that process, or how you actually got the internship, for example, at NASA?
Yeah, so one of the ways is to work through your, for example, if you're at university, is to work through the professors that from whom you're taking classes, right? They make connections through them, find out, hey, I'd really like to work in your lab. Or, you know, do you know somebody who's working on this problem? Because I'd really like to be involved with that. So that kind of networking is a great way to find out about internship opportunities now. And of course, if you now we're all on the internet, and many internship opportunities are now announced through networking sites such as LinkedIn, probably Facebook, and things like this. So that's another way to stay plugged into opportunities. It's much easier now than it was when I was at university, where you had to go see what someone had posted on the billboard, like a physical piece of paper, and send a letter, like a real letter, or make phone calls. So it's much, much easier now to find out about those opportunities. But I would certainly say, look for those opportunities. Here in New Zealand, there are so many companies that now offer internships. In fact, where I work at the Paihau Robinson Research Institute, we offer summer internships as well for students who are interested in physics research. So, and some of those students end up getting hired as research assistants after graduation. So there are many, many opportunities out there at universities, at companies, at different institutions. And so just again, look, talk to your professors, talk to other students, join networking, look for network opportunities like LinkedIn in order to find those opportunities here.
Yeah, that's really great to hear, especially even with the opportunities here in New Zealand. So yeah, going back to you going into your master's, also take us through the process of you like deciding that geology was what you would want to focus on. And then also, what were the projects that you ended up like working on?
Yes. So while I was at university and I was taking physics classes, at one point I had the opportunity to take some additional science classes, and I signed up for a geology class. I thought, hey, that'll be interesting. I'll learn more about that. And as it was a real eye-opener, I loved it. It was slideshows about rocks and field trips to see, you know, go hike around and explore the environment and learn about the history of the Earth. And so for me, that was fantastic. And I found out that I really loved it. And so that was part of the reason that I ended up kind of shifting a focus a little bit to say, you know, I really enjoy physics, but I can't really see becoming a physicist. But a lot of what I learned is going to be very applicable to geology, because again, physics is fundamental to so many sciences. And so a background in physics and chemistry and so forth served me very well going into geology. And so one of the things I love about geology is that you're kind of like a detective in that you come on to the scene, you know, in the case of geology, millions of years later, and you have to say, okay, here's a set of rocks. What happened here? You know, what clues can I pull from this scene? And, you know, it's some combination of how the rocks are arranged and what the physics was that left them there and the chemistry of the rocks and how the elements form together into minerals. And all of that tells a story. And so by putting all those clues together, you can assemble this history of what happened in the past. And that is kind of a fun puzzle-solving challenge. You know, can be kind of addictive. And so when I finished at university, I said, well, what do I want to do? And I had the opportunity to go actually apply Earth geology to other planets. And in my case, I went to a university called Brown University in the United States. That's sort of in the northeastern corner of the United States and the smallest state in the United States called Rhode Island. And so I had the opportunity there to work on a mission called Magellan. So Magellan was a mission that was mapping the surface of the planet Venus. Now, the Venus is completely enclosed in clouds. So if you were in a spacecraft orbiting Venus, you wouldn't see much of anything. It's just sort of yellowish clouds. But if you have a radar, you can see through those clouds and see the surface. And so people were very curious about the surface of Venus. And so I had the opportunity to work on a mission, and NASA had sent this mission Magellan to Venus. And we took that data and we're interpreting it to figure out what all the different surface features were. And of course, like the moon, you have things like craters and so forth. But the other features that were all over the surface were all volcanic. So there's no oceans on Venus. The surface is hundreds of degrees centigrade, so extremely hot. Venus actually has a very extreme greenhouse effect. So a very, very thick atmosphere, which traps the heat there. So I became one of the people who was using this data in order to help understand how Venus got to be the way it is and how it's both the same and different from Earth. It's about the same size of Earth. It's made of the same stuff, but went off on this wildly different evolutionary path. So Earth is very conducive to life. We have liquid oceans, very comfortable temperatures. Venus is, you know, it's very, very hot. It's closer to the sun, but the primary reason it's so hot is because of its thick carbon dioxide atmosphere that traps all the heat. So that tells us a lot, not only about Venus, but about Earth and how Earth could have been on a very different path. And it helps us understand what path Earth could take in the future, for example, if we don't get our greenhouse gas emissions under control. And then you have a planet like Mars, which has started out very Earth-like, but evolved in a completely different direction. It's now in a perpetual ice age. And that's so you can look at the Earth now in the context of all of its sibling planets and understand the different directions that planets can take based on almost the same, but not exactly the same initial starting conditions. And so it helps us then understand the Earth better because we can test our hypotheses, right? You can say, oh, I think the Earth evolved this way for this reason. And then you could say, but let's look at Venus, let's look at Mars and see, you know, does that make sense now? Because we have different planets to compare it to. So that's one of the things I love about planetary geology is it gives you this whole laboratory of planets that you can use in order to test your ideas and see if they check out.
Wow. Yeah, it's such a fascinating area of research, can imagine. And I guess all of these were done while you were still doing your master's degree. Is that right?
So my master's degree was specifically about Venus, but there were explorations of Mars going on at that time. I didn't happen to work on that personally. And when I left university and went and got a job at NASA JPL, that was when had the opportunity to work on some of the Mars missions. So that was a fantastic thing. I was really glad to participate in that effort.
Yeah, I am like super excited to talk to you about your role on the Mars Curiosity missions, which of course, I think lit up every child's imagination, like about, what is it now, 10 years ago or more. So yeah, I guess you were at JPL at that time already and have already worked on other types of projects and research. How did you get involved with the Mars Curiosity mission to start with?
Yes. So at JPL, it's a kind of a, or I should say NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We call it JPL for those unfamiliar with it. But there are scientists who study the planets and engineers who design missions to go to those planets working very closely together. And that's a great way to make these missions successful, is to have these people understand one another and work closely together to make these missions a success. And so by the time I started on Mars Curiosity, I had already worked on several missions in advance of that and built up the set of skills I would need. So for example, I worked on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, a science instrument that went on that orbiter that went around Mars and was imaging and looking at the surface of Mars. And then I worked on a mission called Dawn, which was studying two asteroids in the solar system. And asteroids are fascinating because they are the building blocks of the solar system. So they are material from which the planets were made. So if you want to understand the early solar system and how we got to be where we are now, you want to study asteroids. So my role on that project was to work with the people providing the science instruments that go on a spacecraft. So you could think about your spacecraft, you know, what do you need to study an asteroid? And in this case, we had cameras and we had a instrument called a spectrometer, which images the surface and can tell you what minerals are present by the way those minerals reflect light back to the spacecraft. And we had a third instrument, which looked for radiation that was given off by the surface. And that was a way to detect where water was present. And so these three science instruments were provided by institutions around the world. And so we had to work with these institutions, first of all, to make sure that those science instruments would accomplish what the scientists needed. They would provide the data needed to answer the science questions that we had about those asteroids, and that they would work successfully with the spacecraft and with each other. So that means, do they mechanically fit? Are they too heavy? Are they electrically compatible? You know, how much power do they use? Do the computers talk to each other? And if you've ever hooked up a bunch of computer equipment randomly, often it doesn't work the first time. And now you can imagine if everyone makes a custom thing and brings it together for the first time, that's even more challenging. So essentially, you develop the procedures and the knowledge of how to do this successfully. And a huge part of that job is actually communicating between the people to make sure that everyone understands what they need to do. What are their requirements? And when do they need to deliver? And what do they need to send us to make sure that all the parts are going to work together successfully? And when you have a problem, and you will, how do you solve it? So those communication skills are also really vital. So the Dawn mission was a success. And when I was finished with that, then I had the opportunity to do a very similar job on the Mars Curiosity rover mission. And instead of three instruments, it had 10. So you can think of the Mars Curiosity rover as kind of a van driven by a geologist. And the van is crammed full of science instruments. And so the geologist is driving around looking for interesting things. In this case, the geologist is a robot, with cameras for eyes that it drives around and collects samples and then runs them through the science instruments in the back of the van. And that's kind of the model for the Mars rover. So we had science instruments from 10 different countries. We had 10 different science instruments. We had several different countries. We had from Canada, France, Germany, Russia, and Spain and Germany all contributed to the Mars Curiosity.
Wow. And just maybe a little bit of a segue, how does those partners and instruments actually get assigned or maybe picked to get on the mission?
Yes, so that's a great question. So the way this works is that NASA, for in this example, will put together a plan that says we're going to send a rover to Mars and we need it to answer the following certain number of science questions. Okay, people around the world, if you want to be part of this mission, you need to propose to us what you would put on this rover in order to answer those science questions. And so you have dozens and dozens of institutions around the world who want to be part of this, who will propose, okay, pick my camera, pick my spectrometer, pick my rock drill, pick, mineral analysis tool that I have built here. And so people put together these proposals and they say, okay, I'm going to build this thing and it's going to be this big and it's going to weigh this much and it's going to use this much power and it will solve the following science questions. And then there's essentially a competition to pick the ones that are most likely to work and require the fewest resources, right? You have weight limits, you have power limits, you have all these, you're really constrained in what you can do. So you want to pick the instruments which are most efficient in terms of what they're able to generate for the amount of resources that they use. But you also want to pick ones that you know are going to work. So you don't, so there's a trade-off there, right? And so there's a big competition. And the ones that are selected at the end of that were these 10 science instruments that ended up being on the rover. So, and it's not just NASA that does this. So the European Space Agency will follow a similar process when they send a mission out. So sometimes NASA will provide a science instrument that goes on a European mission, for example, and it's the same sort of process. It's a competitive process and you hope to get picked. And then if you're picked, you hope that you can build what you promised to build.
Yes, that's really great to hear, especially for, you know, countries that don't really or can't afford to really do any kind of mission, but to that's basically right. Piggyback and be part of a bigger one that's being done by the U.S. So, yeah, that's really fascinating. And so, I guess as a second part to that question then is that, In particular, for the Curiosity mission, what are the primary mission objectives for the mission that all of these potential partners have gone and proposed for?
So the big question for Mars, of course, we all want to know, did life ever evolve there? You know, that's a huge question. I mean, not only a science question, but it's an interesting, you know, sort of ethical and human question. And so the short answer is we don't know, but one way that we can get at that question is to ask smaller questions first, simpler questions that we can answer first. And one of the questions and the primary driver behind the Curiosity mission was Mars ever habitable? And what habitable means is, was it compatible with the development of Earth-like life? Doesn't mean that life evolved, but we say, were the conditions right? And so examples of questions that we could ask that help address that are, was there a lot of water? Was it, you know, we want to make sure it's mostly fresh water, so not too salty, not too acidic, not too basic. Were the right ingredients present? So you want to know that there was carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, sulfur, phosphorus, all the things that we are made of. You want to know, were there energy sources available for life to use had it evolved? And on Earth, some life is driven by photosynthesis, so light from the sun that would have been available on Mars. Some life is driven by what's called chemosynthesis, so essentially deriving life energy rather from chemical reactions. And so you see that for some very deep sea kind of life where there isn't any sunlight. So both, you know, those are all options. So you want to look at all of those clues and try to put together a set of science instruments that will answer those questions. So we wanted to then pick a spot on Mars where hopefully we would have seen evidence that helps address these questions. And so that's what the Mars Curiosity rover mission was focused on. And long story short, we found that yes, Mars was habitable, and it probably was about, you know, 3.5 billion years ago. So a billion years or so after Mars would have formed. So Mars is about the same Earth age as Earth. So again, that's an intriguing clue. Okay, all the right parts were there. Still doesn't answer the question we really want to get at, but we can approach that question by answering simpler questions first.
Wow. Yeah, that's really fascinating. And then going back to your experience on the mission itself, what was the most exciting part of it? I mean, I know when it actually launched, you know, everybody was like holding their breath on if it was actually going to work, because I guess from my understanding is the way that it was landing was the first time, I guess it's called the SkyTrain or
yes.
Yeah. So maybe let's talk about that. I'm just like fascinated about, it's almost like a gamble of doing something that's really has not been done before for such a huge rover, which of course Curiosity is as, I guess, as big as a Mini Cooper.
Yeah. Yes, so that's exactly right. It's about 1,000 kilograms. So yeah, and about the size of a Mini Cooper. And yes, so the landing was perhaps the most terrifying part of the mission. So we referred to it as the 7 minutes of terror. So if you have the opportunity, I would highly encourage you to go check out. There's actually a NASA video called 7 minutes of terror. So be sure and take a look. But yeah, what is terrifying about it is that, as you say, this process, we did the best we could to test all the parts on Earth, but we couldn't test the whole process end to end. There was just no way to simulate all of that without sending the rover to Mars. You can't simulate the atmosphere. You can't simulate the gravity, or you can't test it, right? You do your best to simulate it in a computer and with various parts of the process. But yes, so when the spacecraft is approaching Mars, it's going many, many times the speed of sound, and you have about 7 minutes to get it from that speed to resting on the surface. And so that's a combination of processes. First, it goes through the atmosphere in an aeroshell where it heats up extremely hot and it's protected by that aeroshell. And when it slows down enough, that aeroshell comes off and it puts out a parachute, and that slows it down even further. And then as it gets close to the surface, it cuts the parachute off and comes down on rockets. And as it gets close to the surface, it was lowered to the surface by a crane. So that whole thing was something that it had to do autonomously. And I think this is something that I think often we don't communicate well, is that because Mars is so far from Earth, we can't tell the rover to do things in real time. The closest Mars ever gets to Earth, it would take 3 minutes for a signal to get to Mars and 3 minutes for the rover to reply and tell us something. So there's no real time commanding. And so when the rover was landing on Mars, it turned out it was about 7 minutes for the signal to get to us from where Mars was in the solar system compared to the Earth. So by the time we saw on Earth that it was starting its descent to Mars, the rover had either been successful or not. And we had no way to know. We just had to wait and watch. So it's very intimidating because, you know, you have done the best you can, but the rover's all on its own. And all you can do is wait there and see if everything was going to be successful or not. And sometimes, quite frankly, it's not.
Were you in mission control?
So I was not in the one you saw on TV. There were actually two. One was all the people who were monitoring the landing, and that's the one that you might have seen on TV. There was a second one, which is the group of people who took over once the rover had landed successfully. Mm. So I was in the second one. But of course, we got the fun part to take over the rover once the landing was finished. So that was a great opportunity. But I was there on the scene when the rover landed. And of course, we were all very, very excited and excited to, you know, start operating it in this new environment. And that all worked really, really smoothly. We were very excited, but a lot, 10 years of planning had gone into making that successful, you know, so, and the efforts of thousands of people, you know, so I think it's important to acknowledge that.
Wow. I just can't, I know I can't imagine like how excited you all are who actually worked on it for years and seeing it really be successful. So, yeah, I mean, in your view, what is like from then until now, what was the most exciting thing that you think that you participated in terms of the mission?
So I would say the thing I loved most about the mission was coming in every morning and opening up my laptop, and I could look at pictures that the rover had sent. And it was a scene that no one in human history had ever seen before. No one, the rover goes over a hill into a new valley or a new crater. No one has ever seen that. We're seeing it all for the first time. And for those that don't know, the data from the rovers is actually posted. It's available to the public pretty much immediately as soon as it comes down. So if you go and you search for NASA, Mars Curiosity rover raw data, you can actually see the images unprocessed. They just come through and you see all, everything that comes through. Sometimes there are data dropouts or things like that. You'll see that too. So all of that data is available for people to view. So that was one of my favorite parts of the job. As far as things that were very exciting, I think, and as a geologist, this was very near and dear to my heart, was one of the first times we found signs that there had been flowing rivers in this part of Mars where the Curiosity rover was. We landed in a place called Gale Crater. And what the geologist found was rounded stones like you'd find in the bottom of a river. And one of the questions that we wanted to answer, of course, was there water and was it present for a long period of time? And if you have those stones that are rounded, that means that you had water flowing for a very long time because it was able to wear them down into this round shape. So it wasn't just you had one, sort of big flood and it was over. This was something that was going on for a really long time. So that says, hey, we had the conditions that were conducive to life. We had water present for a long time. And by looking at the minerals that were in that water, you could say this was fresh water. This was water that would have been good for the evolution of life. So that was one of the ways we were able to answer that really crucial science question with, was Mars conducive to the development of Earth-like life? And again, 3.5 billion years ago, answer was yes. Since then, Mars has become much less hospitable, and that's a whole nother story.
Wow, that just it blows my mind. You've got such a cool job. So I guess I wanted to ask, looking into the future, and of course, we're using robotics and robotic missions today to go into places like Mars. But what do you see, say in 10, 20 years, what would be the role of robotics in even future missions going even further and maybe beyond, and then also for human settlements as well?
Yeah, so I think, it's, first of all, since the start of the space program, people and robots have been working together. Often we will send robots someplace first to explore and find out if the environment is hospitable to humans. That was true on the moon. So NASA actually sent a number of robotic missions to the moon prior to people landing there, as an example. So I think there will always be a role for sending robots as pioneers before people go anywhere, because robots are while they're expensive and difficult to build and test, it's much, much less difficult than keeping a person alive in that environment. So you allow the robots to do that initial work for you. So I can see people and robots working closely together as we continue to explore the solar system. And there are so many open questions still, even within our solar system. We've done kind of the initial survey. So you can think of this as, you know, when our ancestors were exploring the Earth for the first time, right? They might have passed by an island and maybe didn't stop there. They saw it was there and they said, well, we'll come back later and check that out in more detail. That's kind of where we are with the solar system, right? Is now we, you know, flown by some of these outer planets, for example, but we'd really like to go back because that first flyby was really intriguing and there were so many mysteries we were left with. And now we want to go see what it's really like there. So we've done a lot of exploration of the moon. We've done a lot of exploration of Mars. We're sending missions back to Venus to look at that more closely. And people are now starting to say, well, okay, we've looked at Mars for life, but what about icy moons? So if you look at Europa, the moon of Jupiter, right, it has an ice shell, but underneath that is an ocean. Could there be life there? We don't know the answer. How do we design something that can go through a kilometer or two of ice and then explore the ocean underneath? How do we design something that can accomplish that? Send us the data back. We all want to know that. We all want the Europa submarine, right? But we're going to send robots to do that first before we'd ever send people. And designing those robots and the instruments to go on them is something that all of us can participate in. And students who are interested in this sort of work, there's going to be so much going on both here in New Zealand and around the world. So there'll be many opportunities to collaborate on efforts like that. There's Titan, the moon of Saturn, which is covered by all different sorts of clouds, essentially made of these really heavy hydrocarbons. So things you would normally think of as fuels make up like whole oceans on Titan. That's fascinating. What's going on there? So again, these are opportunities for us to now go back and ask some more detailed questions because now we have this initial survey of the solar system. Now let's find those interesting places and go back.
Yeah. Oh, just like super exciting on what's going to happen in the next few decades. And of course, for the audience, this is going to be your generation who will be exploring. So just super great to be hearing all of this potential opportunities. So going now back to the present time, you've come to New Zealand and are now part of the Robinson Research Institute as part of the Victoria University. Yeah, can you tell us a little bit more about like what you're doing in terms of high temperature superconducting magnets for space applications?
Yes, absolutely. So we had the opportunity to come here. We'd always looked for the opportunity to work abroad because I really enjoy working with people from different countries. I loved that in my previous job and having the opportunity to actually go and live somewhere and work with a new group of people was fantastic from my own personal point of view, because I find when I work with new people, I learn so much. And it's such a great opportunity. And it was a great opportunity for us to exchange knowledge. So the group here was funded to fly a demonstration of some new technologies in space. So the new technologies that we want to demonstrate are a high temperature superconducting magnet and its power supplies, a wireless inductive power supply, we call a flux pump. And the value of this is that people are looking at the application of a magnet to improving the efficiency of rocket thrusters. So when I talk about rocket thrusters, I'm not talking about the kind that get a rocket off the ground. I'm talking about the kind that allow a satellite in space to maneuver and orient itself. And if we think about satellites around the Earth, for example, one of the things that really limits their lifetime, how long they can stay and operate successfully in space, is how much fuel they have to maneuver themselves and orient themselves in space. Mm-hmm. Once that's gone, your mission is finished. And so if you're interested in sustainability, if you're interested in making our resources last longer, one way to do that is to make the use of that fuel much more efficient. And so we'd like to demonstrate this technology, show that it works in space. And in parallel on the ground, we have a team looking at how the efficiency of these thrusters is improved by having these magnets in place. So we can demonstrate the technology in space, show that it works on the ground, and then put these two things together with the idea that someone can then take that, run with it, and turn it into a commercial product. So we have this demonstration of this technology that we are planning to fly to the International Space Station. So it will operate there for about 15 weeks. We hope to see it go to the space station in 2025. So take several years for this sort of thing to come together. So my part of it, of this particular mission, is to help the team develop ways to test, to validate that these technologies are going to be able to survive the journey to space and operate successfully there. And then when they come back, we'll validate that nothing changed. So that's our collaboration, is that I'm bringing my background working on getting things into space, making sure they operate successfully there. And the team here, I'm learning a lot from them about superconducting magnets and power supplies, which is something new for me. So I think that's been a fantastic opportunity, and I'm really glad to be able to contribute in that way.
Wow. And I know you mentioned earlier that there are internships that are available as well. So I guess winding down on the interview, these are, of course, potential opportunities for either students or researchers in New Zealand to also focus on. What do you see other opportunities that would be coming out of this particular research that the students today might look into as opportunities for the near term or maybe a midterm future for them here in New Zealand?
So I think that's a great question. So I think first of all, if you're interested in the kind of work we're doing here at the Paiha Robinson Research Institute, feel free to go to our website. There's information about applying for internships there. I think they might have wrapped up for this year, but they offer them yearly. And that'll be true actually for a number of universities and institutes throughout New Zealand, and also companies. So I would say, you know, there are internships offered on the South Island, offered up here on the North Island as well. And there are so many companies that are blossoming in New Zealand in the aerospace industry. And so there are people working on green aviation. There are people working on space applications, like we talked about. There are, so depending on what your background is, whether it's chemistry, physics, math, computers, all of those skills are needed. But we also need people who can communicate effectively. We need people who can teach. We need people who can share the excitement. So regardless of what your background is, there's some role for you if you're excited about this field. So I would say, talk to your teachers, talk to your professors, start making those connections and reach out. I mean, because sometimes just, reaching out to somebody and they may get back to you with an opportunity. And again, it's so easy now to find these opportunities because people advertise them on the internet. So definitely, I think great opportunities for students and a really bright future for aerospace here in New Zealand.
That's awesome. And just maybe in general, do you also have any other recommendations or resources that you'd like to share, either books, online websites, people that you potentially watch or follow?
So I would say the there are so many resources that NASA and ESA make available. So New Zealand is coming up to speed in terms of making resources available for students. But there is a lot of material that's put out there for specifically for students at all different sorts of levels. So even if you're a primary student, there's material there for you to engage you. There's a lot of outreach material. And so I would say, you know, go to those websites. There's so much information there. They have videos, they have teaching materials, they have, they want people to come in and take advantage of those resources. And I'm hoping that a similar system will be set up here in New Zealand, not only for students, but also for teachers, because I think for teachers, it's really crucial to be able to reach students and to communicate to them, you know, why is this important? Why should I learn this? Okay. And then you can say, well, here are people actually using this. People do use math, people do use physics, and here's what they do with it, you know, and it provides a great motivation. And it's something, you know, it's a different way to reach people. So definitely encourage folks to check that out. And yeah, I would say, you know, I'm just coming up to speed on everything going on in New Zealand. I've been here just a short time, but there's, yeah, just a lot of very interesting work going on down in the Christchurch area, up in Auckland, and here in Wellington as well. So wherever you are, there's work going on. And yeah, just jump in and do some research and get started.
Yeah, thank you. And so before we close, do you have any other general parting words for anyone who would like to follow particularly the same career path as you have?
Yeah, so I'd say if you're curious, you will never be bored. If you want to do this kind of work, you have to accept that sometimes you will fail. Sometimes things won't work out. It will be hard sometimes. So find your support network. That might be your family, it might be your friends, might be, you know, your colleagues at work. And so I would say, you know, if you build that support network around you to help you succeed, that makes a huge difference. And I would say, work on all of your skills. So people think about maths and science, but you also need the ability to write. You also need the ability to work effectively with people. Those are all crucial skills. So you can think of them all as tools in your toolbox. Look for opportunities to work on all of those things. And then as you're developing and thinking about things you want to do, look for those internships, look for those opportunities to work in somebody's lab. And that helps you not only to find out what you like, but also what you don't like. And that can be a crucial part of the process. So there's no one right path, you know, to get to where you want to go. And there'll be some experiments and you'll find some dead ends, things that don't work for you, but that's okay. You know, you have an opportunity to get started on a great journey. And I think that's fantastic for all of us to know that we have something like that in our future.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Bettina, for sharing your experiences and insights, especially to the New Zealand community and audience and beyond. So yeah, it was great having you.
So glad to have done this, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you like Space Base's work and would like to support us, please check us out on spacebase.co. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.